Well, I get pig-headed and I drink too much. I'm out of state and I'm out of touch. Got a reckless heart and a beggar's knee. I could write a book,
he could write a book
about me. Well, I don't say much, but I love to talk. Got a funny way and a funny walk. Got a point of view that's hard to see. I could write a book,
he could write a book
about me. It's a hard story with soft cover. Every heart is double-spaced. For a bookmark, there's a bottle, so I don't lose my place.
You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Gary Lee Miller, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Sean Prentice, whose new book, Finding Abby, tells the story of the author's search for the hidden grave of author and radical environmentalist Edward Abbey. The book was published earlier this year by University of New Mexico Press. I interviewed Sean Prentice at his home in northern Vermont. To get there, I turned off the main highway and onto the dirt road that led me along the shore of a small, isolated, and stunningly beautiful lake. Sean met me at the end of his driveway with news that he just sighted a bald eagle cruising the sky over his house. He led me past the garage to a small, well-built home with a broad, enclosed porch looking down onto one of the lake's hidden coves. At the edge of the water, two Adirondack chairs sat on the end of a short dock, a canoe resting nearby. As I got to know Sean Prentice, I realized this was the perfect place for him to be. Raised in suburban Long Island, a place where he never felt at home, Prentice found solace in the wild places, first in Pennsylvania's Delaware Water Gap region, then in the American Southwest. In the wild, Prentice also found a writing life. In his work, he focuses on creative and environmental essays, poetry, and short stories. He's the co-editor of The Far Edges of the Fourth Genre, an anthology on the craft of creative nonfiction, and the co-author of Environmental and Nature Writer, a craft guide and anthology, forthcoming in 2016 from Bloomsbury Press. Prentice teaches at Norwich University in Northfield, Vermont, where he also runs the Norwich University Writers Series and the Chameleon Literary Journal. He's the creative editor of Backcountry Magazine. As Sean Prentice and I sat down to talk, I noticed two water birds paddling across the cove below. Prentice had mentioned hooded mergansers frequented the cove, and I wondered if these were the birds. He grabbed a handy pair of binoculars and took a look. "Nope, mallards," he said, and then our interview began. Hi, Sean. Thanks for agreeing to come on, write the book, and talk about your new book, Finding Abby. It's great to have you.
It's my pleasure to be here, Gary. Thanks so much for offering me this opportunity.
I guess I tried to think of a way to sum up this book, and I think the way I would sum it up is it's both a literal and a metaphorical journey of yours to try to find the hidden grave of Edward Abbey. And I'm wondering if you could just set the stage for us by reading a bit from the book's prologue.
Yeah, I'll happily read. This is maybe the third or fourth paragraph in to the prologue. But can a person precisely point as if on a map to the origin of a true transformative journey? Is there any proper beginning? If there is a beginning to a journey, then this journey to find Edward Abbey's hidden grave might begin on one sleepless night in 2008 as I walk again through my recently purchased home in Grand Rapids, Michigan. A year ago, I moved from northern Idaho to this metropolitan area with its 700,000 people. I left Idaho's wild mountains and rivers for a career job in the city. Soon after arriving in Grand Rapids, I purchased a house, this house, and now I walk through it each night. And each night, this craftsman house echoes emptiness and loneliness at me. This house reminds me that I am still single, This house makes me fret over having one job for the rest of my life. The rest of my life spent in one place, in this city, in this house. Outside this house, the black of night has been washed away by evenly spaced streetlights casting their sodium vapor glow until these streetlights are the city's only constellations. I'm a country boy, born in the ancient and broken hills of Pennsylvania. I came of age in the mountains of the West. For all my 38 years, I've never learned cities. I don't understand house upon house, long lines of traffic, buildings that block out the sun. So my journey begins here, knowing I need to get out of the devastation that we call the city, out of this job we call a career. And what better way to break free of these emotional fences than to begin a journey, a sally, to hit the road, to hunt for something secret. It's so far away that it feels as if it is in terra incognito, beyond the edges of all the maps.
Wow, that was great. Thank you. You're a very good reader.
Thanks, Gary.
When I started the book, you know, I knew a little bit about Edward Abbey. I'd heard that he was kind of an environmental activist and a writer. He wrote a lot about the outdoors. And I knew his book, The Monkey Wrench Gang. I knew of it. And I knew of the concept of kind of monkey wrenching, you know, kind of all-out efforts to stop development, things like that. But I didn't really know much about him. So I was wondering, for the benefit of listeners who don't know a lot about Edward Abbey, if you could maybe just tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, Edward Abbey was born in the late 1920s in southwestern Pennsylvania, in Indiana, Pennsylvania, which is right next to home, Pennsylvania, which is what he considers his home. And he grew up poor on a kind of a rural ranch to a mother who was very much into religion and a father who was a wobbly, a workers activist. And then Abbey ended up traveling west on the GI Bill. He served at the very, very end of World War II. He was actually a military cop, which is really funny because once he got out to college, he became an anarchist. So it's kind of interesting to think that his only job in the military was to police everyone else. But once he got out west, he realized that he was home. And he graduated from the University of New Mexico with his grad degree and his undergrad degree. And while there, he fell in love with the desert landscape, started writing, started publishing, and pretty soon thereafter, he started publishing book after book after book. And by the time of his death in 1989, he had 21 different books published. His best are Desert Solitaire, which is all about the Arches National Park. Back then, it was a national monument. The Monkey Wrench Gang, all about eco-sabotage. And then my favorite book, The Fool's Progress, which is about a man alone at the end of his life, traveling home from the West to West Virginia, but, you know, it seems more like Southern Pennsylvania, and it's kind of like an autobiographical, beautiful, beautiful novel.
Well, that's great. I wasn't aware that he wrote that kind of story about himself. Is it kind of a veiled autobiography?
It's one of those autobiographical novels. I mean, there's plenty of things that are not true in it.
Yeah.
But sure. There's plenty of things that are. I mean, the end of Abbey's life, I mean, he died pretty young at age 62, and he was obviously sick, obviously heading towards death. And The Fool's Progress was written right before that, and probably when he suspected he was not going to live tons longer. You know, and he travels home, or Henry Lightcap travels home in the book back to, you know, more or less the home Pennsylvania region. And it's a spectacular novel. If you like novels, Abbey always wanted to write the fat masterpiece of the great American novel. And this is the only time I think he did it.
Wow, that's great. What makes him as important as a writer?
A few different things. One is, if you are an environmental writer, I mean, he's in the pantheon just for his environmental ideas and his environmental descriptions. So, you know, you go Muir, Thoreau, and then I would go, you know, Leopold and then Abbey. I think he's right in that lineage. But also part of it was he took the ideas of anarchism and he melded them with the ideas of environmentalism. And out of that spawned, eco-sabotage and the Monkey Wrench Gang. And then out of that sprang Earth First. And out of Earth First, what they did, they were a radical environmental organization. And what they did is they offered a radical version of environmentalism, which made the Sierra Club, which used to be considered radical, seem very, very, very center of the road. So he helped yank the environmental discussion way from the right, you know, deep into the center, and then pulled it left. So I think he's really, really important for how he moved the environmental discussion.
Sure. Abbey was a public figure, but also a very private person in many ways. And when he died, he left a mystery. And I was wondering if you could read a bit about that from the book's prologue. And it's the second section I've marked there.
All right. From the prologue. "Or my journey begins not with a definitive date, but as all journeys must, with the discovery of a mystery. So this journey could have begun when I learned sometime in the late 1990s about Abby's mysterious burial. Abby died in Tucson, Arizona in 1989 at age 62 from internal bleeding. After his death, four friends transported his body to the desert. There they illegally buried him in a grave hidden to all but his friends and family and those turkey vultures banking overhead. His friends laid a hand-chiseled basalt tombstone atop the grave. The stories tell us that the tombstone reads, Edward Abbey, 1927 to 1989. No comment. We know when Abbey died. We know where he died. We know how he died. But no one but those closest to Abbey knows where he is buried. This journey is about the need to unravel, thread by thread, this mystery, to follow where those threads lead. It's because humans need mystery, because a person like me, who's been stated on the wrong kinds of food, scarcity, and home ownership, and a steady paycheck in the city, becomes hungry for something nourishing, something healthy, something real. Or maybe we are pulled by mystery like we are pulled by wilderness, that desire to enter self-willed lands."
Thanks. Can you talk a little bit about what drew you to Edward Abbey and his work? What do you and Edward Abbey have in common, I guess, or...
The things I love about Ed Abbey is, so I was not a writer through my undergrad. I was a business major. My family is in business. So it was, I guess I expected I would just go into that business field. And towards the tail end of my college, when it was close for me to graduate and do something with my life, my best friend who's in the book, House, he gave me a copy of Desert Solitaire. And he said, "I just read this book in school. You need to read it." And I remember sitting in my backyard, and I'd always thought of writers as pretentious people, you know, just who cared so much about their art that they couldn't actually engage with other humans or in the natural world. Then I opened up Desert Solitaire, and here's this guy who's, you know, sitting out in the middle of the desert, drinking a beer, making funny jokes, wandering off into the desert, and being all sorts of contradictions. And he seemed like, maybe not like my friends and me, but someone my friends and I would want to hang out with, someone we would want to get to know, someone we'd want to hike with. So he seemed like an organic human, and I loved that voice. And then the other thing is, he's not afraid to tell you exactly what he thinks. He will, you know, berate you if he thinks you deserve a berating. He will praise you if he thinks you deserve that. But he will tell you exactly what he's thinking at all times. And he will defend what he believes is most valuable. Normally, it's the environment at all costs. And I find that really, really beautiful and something I think about emulating. I don't know if I have any of Abbey's traits, but I love learning from him.
And were you always interested in the outdoors? Did you, or was that just come with Edward Abbey?
No, I grew up on Long Island. But every summer, we would go to Pennsylvania, to where my family originally was from. They settled in that area in the 1740s. And we'd return to that same town where we'd spent, you know, 250 years. And I lived on a river. I lived against a mountain all those summers. So I'd bounce back and forth between the wasteland of suburbia, which never felt like home, and this river and this hill that always felt like home. So, you know, if you ask me where I'm from, I'll tell you Pennsylvania, but I'm really from New York, but I feel no connection to Long Island, but I feel a deep, deep connection to those dark, deep, ancient hills of Pennsylvania. And my mom is a big environmentalist, so she taught me to care about the earth, to protect it, to really think about what was happening to our Delaware River. So then when I went west to college at Western State College, those ideas traveled with me, and I, you know, spent time outdoors. But then Abbey offered me a new way to conceive of wilderness, a new way to conceive of environmental protection.
What made you decide to go on a search for his grave? What do you think you, what were you hoping to find other than the obvious, his grave?
Well, I didn't really care about finding the grave. That was, for me, irrelevant. What I was hoping to find was home. As I read in that first section, I was living in Grand Rapids, Michigan, a wonderful, beautiful city in western Michigan, vibrant, alive, filled with great people and many great friends. But I don't know how to live in a city. I've tried a few different times and I keep failing. So all of a sudden I'm living in the city. I get a career job as a tenure track professor at a wonderful university, Grand Valley State. And I buy a home and I just see the rest of my life here. And every time I open the door to head inside after a day of work, I just think I might be here for the rest of my life. So I went searching for the grave, not because I cared about the grave, though it sure was a fun, exciting mystery to try to track down. But what I cared so much more about is, what do I do with my life? And Abby made those choices, and I don't know if he always made them correctly. He abandoned his wife and two of his kids. He quit jobs, right in the middle of them. He was not always consistent, not always reliable. But I thought I could turn to him as a ghost mentor and kind of ask him these questions as I was searching for his final grave. I could kind of learn from him and try to figure out, where is home? What is home? And what should I do? Should I suck it up and stay in a city and just, you know, is it something about me and I need to learn it? Or is it something about the city and me and I just need to leave?
Yeah. You know, there seems to be a tradition of young men, mostly, I guess, in America, but young people, young women probably do it too, kind of striking out for the wilderness to try to find things. And, you know, Christopher McCandless, very famous one, Everett Royce, another one, and many, you know, people who just love to get out there. And, you know, what do you think why do you think they do that? Why do you think that happens?
Well, I'm from a town, a really small town, Bangor, where my family has been there for, you know, over 250 years. And some of my family has never left. And I'm partly jealous of them having spent their whole life in the roots of our past. But for me, you know, it's a chance to figure out who I am. And the best way for me to figure that out is to remove myself from what I know best, move away from my parents who I love, move away from the town that I know best, give up everything I know and try to put on new clothes. And I think that's why Everett Roos, who traveled into the desert Southwest in the 30s, or Christopher McCandless, you know, went up to Alaska to try to figure out who we are. And I think we're oftentimes pretty privileged to be able to do that. But for those of us able, it's really fun to challenge ourselves in new landscapes and with new peoples.
Right. So in the book, you kind of head out west and you go to a lot of places where Abby had been and you meet, you know, some of his friends. But I was just curious because the whole time you're doing that, you know, you're hiking and you're camping and you're living out of a pickup truck, but you're also writing.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering exactly, you know, can you talk a little bit about how that worked for you and what your process was and doing that?
I'd never written a book before, so I didn't know exactly how to do it. And we were talking earlier about, you know, you writing a novel, and I just have no idea where I begin or end a novel. It seems so foreign, but the beautiful thing about this is the trips were kind of one at a time. So every time I went on a trip, I would come home and I'd have at least 2 or 3 days before I went somewhere else. Or I'd, you know, be in a spot with a couple of days and I would just crank out a chapter. And it might be terribly written, but it would hold all the information I needed. So what I was able to do is just kind of slowly build a really, really mediocre book. And then once I had everything all done, then I could see what I had, what my resources were. And then I could add and remove and move, not really move things around, but heighten or shape. And in the end, based on an editor's read, I ended up cutting out 90 pages worth of material. So this book was maybe about a third bigger before. So, you know, I ended up doing a lot of sculpting. But it was a pretty easy book to get that first draft of,
right,
and then really, really hard to get the final draft.
Did you carry a notebook? Did you make notes while you were actually out on the road, or use a recorder? Or?
I used a recorder. I took notes. I had my laptop with me at times. So I did, you know, anything possible to remember as much as I possibly could. And that would oftentimes mean, you know, having a conversation with somebody, and then, you know, in the bathroom, writing down like great quotes they said, or, you know, as soon as I get done with the night, you know, just trying to crank out as much of a chapter as I possibly could. So I saved those really, right, you know, important nuggets.
Yeah. Well, I want to say that if you started out with a mediocre book, you ended up with a really fine one. And I was wondering if you could read a passage from the book. I was just struck by how beautiful this particular passage was. And it's your description of the Valley of the Shining Stone in New Mexico. And I was wondering if you could just read a little bit from that section.
Yeah, and this is north of Santa Fe, just north of a little town called Abiquiu. And it's a beautiful, beautiful little slice of New Mexico. I used to live just north of here in a little town called Chama. The trail is narrow and winds from the highway towards a rising cliff of shining stone. Atop that raw cliff stands a citadel-like chimney tower. I'm no geologist, but I've learned enough about these cliffs to know that the top band is speckled Dakota rock. Next is the dull brown Morrison band of sandstone, siltstone, and shale. Below that is the limestone and white gypsum of the Totolito band, followed by the yellow fine-grained Entrada band. The driest blood red of the oldest visible band, the Chinlay, runs nearest the desert floor. This rock band, eroded by the rain and snow and wind, is what gives this desert the red sands I love. Soon I'm hiking through scattered pinyon and junipers. Pinyons, New Mexico State's tree, makes their home range in southern Colorado and northern New Mexico. Juniper, when burned in a campfire, smells better than any other wood. Abby wrote in Desert Solitaire, quote, "The odor of burning juniper is the sweetest fragrance on the face of the earth. One breath of juniper smoke, like the perfume of sagebrush after rain, evokes the piercing strangeness of the American West," end quote. These pinyon and junipers, known as the PJ Forest, are the predominant trees in the desert. But as I cross Cajito Arroyo, terrible Spanish, a seasonal stream that runs today, I study the riparian trees, willows, some chewed through by beaver, lance leaf, and cottonwoods with their heart-shaped leaves. I cross the Arroyo on a small swinging bridge. The trail turns from the Arroyo, and as I hike this desert, the sun glows white. I keep walking and thinking about the loneliness of city living and thinking about the long adventure ahead and walking until these circular thoughts on loneliness and adventuring are interrupted by a yucca flowering with giant cream-white blossoms. I stare at the flowers, forgetting for a moment that I live in a city, that I have returned if only for a few days to a city, Santa Fe. I turn to a nearby sage and notice it's green. I pinch off new growth, roll the leaves in my fingers, and pull the crushed leaves to my nose. I inhale deeply the smell of the west, of spring and rebirth. A short distance away, a scraggly walking stick cholla looks like a stick figure cactus man. I inhale, relax, exhale. Realize I've barely seen anything on this hike. I've been walking through the desert rather than walking in the desert. I've been thinking about the throngs of people in Santa Fe and the long drive home, but now it becomes more than place. It becomes something like home. Being present in a place, in this valley of shining stone, is the exact opposite of loneliness.
That's such a beautiful section. By the way, that's Sean Prentice reading from Finding Abby, his new book about his search for the hidden grave of Edward Abbey out on University of New Mexico Press. Such a gorgeous section. Did you have to do a lot of natural history research with this book, or had you come to know the desert and its plants and its, you know, kind of geography or geology over just through spending time there?
One of my best traits is that I have a memory that gets wiped clean immediately. So if someone calls me a jerk, I can forget about it in 2 minutes. But that also is a problem where, you know, I sometimes struggle to remember quotes. I sometimes struggle to remember facts. I know the desert landscape pretty darn well. But if I took you up into my office, I could show you, you know, probably 70 different books that I used while writing this book. You know, I love to think that I'm an expert out there, but so many people would know so much more than me. I've spent a lot of time living out there, a lot of time venturing out there, but it's just such a big, beautiful desert. And some of these are a little bit outside of where I normally travel. So no, I did a lot of research, talked to a lot of people, visit a lot of, you know, resources to help fill in the texture. But it taught me so much about the West, which has been just a wonderful blessing.
Yeah, it sounds like a really enjoyable way to spend your time.
And I think as a professor, I tell my students to research, and so often they push back against it. They hate the idea of research. And I just think of how much fun this book was for all the research that was involved, whether it was, you know, driving to some weird town or talking to one of Abby's great friends or doing natural history research.
Yeah. I actually wanted to ask you a little bit about Abby's friends. You know, you during your journey, you met a number of, you know, people who were side by side with him for long periods of time and spent a lot of time in the wilderness with him, spent a lot of time, you know, involved in kind of activism and things with him, including apparently a little monkey wrenching maybe. Given his kind of reclusive nature, at least part of his reclusive nature, and his last request to be buried in a hidden grave, how did you feel about making contact with these people and, you know, saying, hey, I want to come and talk to you about Edward Abbey?
Well, first off, these were men that I had read about, men that I had learned about, men that I had looked up to. So though they had never met me, I sure knew who the heck they were. And they were, you know, seminal figures in the history of the West environmental movement. So to have an opportunity to talk to Jack and Dave and Ken and Doug was just an amazing opportunity. But it's also pretty darn scary. And first off, these are iconic men, but also these are all big men. I think Ken Slide is the smallest. All the others are well over 6 feet and big, manly men. So, you know, if they don't like my project, if they don't trust me, you know, I've got to deal with, you know, men who are known to defend what they love, and they love Abby. And, you know, that could be a very interesting situation. So, you know, I thought of a couple things before going in. One is that I would, you know, only ask questions that I would feel comfortable answering. So I was not an expose, you know, journalist trying to dig up dirt. What I wanted to hear was about a man and about his story and about Abby's life with his friends. So I think as they heard my questions, they're pretty benign. And really what I'm trying to find out is the story of a man's life and just share that with readers. Because I think Abby is a complicated, beautiful writer and human.
Yeah, were they easy to approach, or was there any tension there initially when you...
Three were very easy. So Jack Loeffler, I had a house from the book, H-A-U-S, got me in connection with Loeffler. So that was a very
easy... And that's your friend from college?
Yeah. He and I have been friends since we were teenagers. So we've been friends almost our whole lives. Ken Slight was relatively easy to connect with because I had another friend who knew his wife. David Peterson was very easy to connect with. But then Doug Peacock, who is the real-life George Washington Hayduke from the Monkey Wrench Gang, was much more difficult. And he was much more difficult because he thought I was doing a very different project. He thought I was writing a guidebook where I'd set out cairns and tell you how to get to Abby's grave.
Oh, right. So he wanted nothing to do with that.
Nothing project. To do with that. And I want nothing to do with that project. But once I articulated to him what I was trying to do, then he said, yeah, fly out to Arizona. I'll do an interview. And once I went out there, I mean, well, first off, we sit down and he puts a 357 Magnum between the two of us. And then he jokingly tells me about how his, you know, he and a friend were talking about, you know, bringing violence to me if I was writing a guidebook. But then after that, we spent 7 hours between the desert and his home just talking nonstop. He invited me back for dinner and ice cream. So what started out as a hard interview to get became 7 wonderful, wonderful hours.
What did you feel like when you pulled out a very large handgun? And
I guess I wasn't worried. I figured I didn't think that any trouble was going to come. And even though he was, you know, talking about physical violence to me, I didn't feel any sense of real physical violence coming. It felt like a joke. And as a writer, I sure knew it'd be a great story. So I guess I trusted Doug. By that point, it was too late in the conversation for him to truly be, you know, threatening to kill me. And if he wants to kill me, he's a former Green Beret medic. I bet you he can. So I just figured, well, let's just have a good interview. And, you know, if he kills me out here and buries me somewhere, then, you know, hopefully my wife, Sarah, will finding Abby on my computer and get it published, and it'll be a really big deal. But I had a feeling that I'd be pretty darn safe.
So what you're saying is you'd rather go for staying alive and perhaps lower sales figures than having a huge hit and shot dead and buried in the desert?
Yep, but the second one offers some good benefits as well, I guess.
Yeah, a little fame.
Yep.
Can you just... I know you did. You mentioned earlier you did a ton of research for this, both in natural history and I'm assuming a lot of research just about Edward Abbey himself. Can you tell me a little bit about what you learned from meeting his friends that you might not have been able to learn in a book?
Yeah, what I learned, a couple different things. One of the biggest things is you can learn a lot about a person by how loyal his friends are. And Abbey's friends, let's see, it's been, you know, 25 years later, 26 years later, are deeply loyal to his ideas and to who the man was. And if people are that loyal to someone, there's something great about that. They could have easily moved on. They could have easily forgotten about him. But their deep friendship, their deep love, and their deep loyalty was something that was really, really beautiful. And you just hear the stories they tell. And they're just one incredible, funny, crazy story upon another. But everyone is laced with this brotherly love that's just a really beautiful thing. So that's the one thing. The other thing is just his dedication to his ideals. He just ran through so many different people and just knocked them away out of his path. And I don't know, you know, he left some hurt behind, but he had a vision and he stayed true to it at all costs. And I think that is, you know, something that you can read about, but until you hear hints of his monkey wrenching. No one told me too many stories, but they all hinted to it. Or about how he saw his writing affect the environmental movement, or the work he did raising funds for organizations. You really got to see a man who didn't just write about it, but lived it. And those are two of many things I got to learn from his friends.
What do you think it was about him that created this kind of fierce loyalty?
That's a great question. I think part of it may have been that they shared so many similar ideas on what they loved, and they enmeshed themselves in defending it. And I think, you know, as you get yourselves into eco-sabotage, you know, you put yourself in a very vulnerable spot, so you have to trust each other. So I think that's part of it. The other thing is they had a lot of wild, crazy experiences, and I think that brought them together. But I also just think Abbey one-on-one, it sounded like he was just a great conversationalist, a brilliant man, and that he and Jack would just have these long discussions. They wouldn't always agree, but they would talk for hours and hours and talk about books, talk about music, talk about the environment. And they did what best friends do, what my best friend, you know, House and I do, which is talk about ideas, test ideas, see who we are. And I think that was a big part of their friendships.
Abbey could be a difficult guy. He had 5 marriages. People say he was, you know, a womanizer. He could get in your face. Some people would say, you know, he was an asshole to me or something like that. Can you talk a little bit about these aspects of his personality?
Yeah. And everything you said seems to be true. I've never met Abbey, so I can't give you first-hand impressions. But he seemed like a womanizer. He seemed like if the opportunity came to hook up with a woman, he did it, whether he was married or not. As I said earlier, he abandoned 2 of his kids and 1 of his wives because he wanted to leave the city, like I did, and he wanted to move back out west. And he did it. He just left them. He's been known to say things that people view as racist. And by people, I mean I would read them that way. Misogynistic things. So there's plenty of easy ways you could critique Abbey, and you'd probably be really right. But Jack Loeffler talks about this idea of conflicting absolutes. And what he means by that is Abbey might have said racist things, and I can't get into his mind or his heart, but maybe he meant them, maybe he didn't. But let's say he did mean them. He also at times raised money for uranium miners who were Native American. And if there's any group of people that Abbey wouldn't probably want to help, it'd be uranium miners who were also Native Americans, who we often talk badly about. You know, but yet he saw them as human. He saw them as downtrodden. He saw them as workers who were down on their luck. So he happily raised money for these people. So on one hand, you have someone who may be a racist, and on the other hand, someone who is, you know, giving their time and effort and money to those same people that others are saying he's a racist about. So these conflicting absolutes are something that makes Abby human, I guess.
Yeah.
But also beautiful. I mean, it sure would be nice if he never said anything that is viewed as racist, but it makes him complex, and it makes him who he is, and it makes him someone that we can learn from.
And I think it's also probably in line with the idea that he tells you exactly what he thinks.
Exactly.
I think there are probably a lot of people who at least have, you know, I think everyone has their own cultural biases, even if it's not, you know, full-fledged racism. But, you know, even if you do, people keep them quiet, and he wasn't the kind of guy who would do that. If he had an opinion about something, he would let it out.
Quickly.
Yeah. He was also a guy who liked to drink, and he actually died of esophageal varices, which is a condition that's commonly associated with alcoholism. It's a kind of internal bleeding. And you seem to go kind of back and forth about that in the book. You talk to some people, a bunch of people, in fact, about whether or not they thought he was an alcoholic. What do you think about, based on what you found, you know, his kind of life and alcohol? Was it, you know, a good thing in his life, a bad thing in his life, you know?
Well, I think if you talk to anyone who's enjoyed alcohol, you'll say yes to if it's a good thing or a bad thing. I've enjoyed plenty of beers, and many of them have been wonderful. Some of them have been, you know, troubling. So I think for any human, you're going to have that wide experience. And Abby's friends, to a person, said that it was definitely not alcoholism that killed him. It'd be really hard to find a doctor who'd offer that same thing. And I don't really care what he died of. We're all going to die of something. So I don't really have a stake in the game. But, you know, he lived a life that enjoyed alcohol in a variety of ways, that used alcohol at times as a coping mechanism for when a wife would leave him, say. And, you know, he, like so many people, didn't have the healthiest relationship with alcohol, but it's definitely a huge part of his life. He and his friends back in the day, when this doesn't sound nearly as bad as it will now, used to measure mileage on car trips with six packs. So if it was a certain amount of miles or, you know, hours, it'd be probably an hour, a six pack. And then, you know, say a second hour would be another six pack. And they would just drink and drive around the West. Something, obviously, we cannot do today.
And we don't recommend.
No, definitely don't recommend.
Do we, Sean?
No, not at all. But that was just, you know, a part of his life, or, you know, going rafting. I mean, they would bring cases and cases of beer. So it was a huge part of his life. I'm sure, you know, as it does for all of us, it took some sort of toll. And the doctors would all say, I mean, it had a huge role.
Yeah, yeah. I actually worked with an old retired Navy vet who would measure his home owner projects by beer. It's a six-pack project. That's a 12-pack project.
Yep.
Anyway, so as you're making this journey, you're also dealing with your own kind of internal struggle, this idea that, you know, am I going to end up living in this city? Am I going to end up, you know, with this job and, you know, just kind of continue living and being in the same place? Can you talk about how this journey changed you?
Yeah, and by the end of the book, I ended up in a very, very different spot. And it's because of this search. And again, the grave is a tangible thing I'm searching for, but what I'm really searching for is home, trying to figure out what home means. And we're having this conversation now in north central Vermont, and we're sitting in a house that is right next to a little lake. And the reason I'm here is because of the search for Ed Abbey. And I now have a ring on my finger. I'm married to Sarah Hingston. And all these things I feel are a direct result of me getting in my pickup truck, traveling the West, and asking questions repeatedly for 2 straight years, trying to figure out what the heck to do with this. So how do I end up differently? I quit my job, moved to a new state, met the woman of my dreams, bought a home. And now instead of being terrified about home ownership, I'm terrified about the prospect. I'm 42 right now. How many more years can I live here? 30? 20? You know, it's a remote spot. It's hard to get down to our house in the winter. What is it going to be like to sell this house? As you and I were talking about earlier, this morning we had hooded mergansers out there and loons and great blue herons. And it's heartbreaking now to think that I might have to leave what I consider my home. Whereas when I was looking for Abby's grave, when I was looking toward Abby as a mentor, you know, having a house, owning a house was the worst thing for me. And now it's the most beautiful thing because I found it. I found what I need.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, as I read this through the book, I had a lot of thoughts, but one of them was that, you know, Abby is a bit of a double-edged sword in that he loved these places so much, yet he also drew attention to them, which in a certain way may have been damaging to them. And I was wondering, there's a section in the book, a chapter called Being Industrial Tourists in Arches National Park. And I was wondering if you might read a little bit from that section.
So this is about my time with my research assistant, Katie, in Arches. And an industrial tourist is someone who does tourism from the window of their car. So now we're driving into Arches. Within moments, we return to well-maintained Arches, passing Balanced Arch, turning past Pothole Arch and Ham Rock. At Double Arch, Katie and I get out of my truck. In Desert Solitaire, Abby wrote, quote, "The road ends at the Double Arch campground," end quote, quote, which means that the campground was here somewhere beneath our feet, beneath pavement. With the campground long gone, Katie and I hike the short distance to Double Arch. At its base, we pass a family, 7 strong, posing for a photo. We ignore them, climb into the two arches, which stand side by side, and take photos. As I click away on my camera, I want to feel better than the people around me, as if I'm more engaged in this landscape because I'm here on research. But just like everyone else, we're merely visitors, looking for panoramic views. There's little to do but accept that I'm a car tourist, snapping easy photographs on a drive-by visit to the national park. Abby would snicker, and I snicker at myself while Katie sits under Double Arch. I look over her shoulder at the world surrounding us, hoodoos, caves, pour-offs, fins, pockets, fingers, drip castles, arches, bridges, walls. Imagine it, and it becomes true. Still, Abby is right. You can't see this beauty from a truck. You need to get out, not just on these short jaunts. I'm seeing the beauty, but I'm not feeling it burning like the sun on my shoulders and lips and nose until they bleed and blister. To see it, you need time and quiet, and even aloneness, or is it loneliness? You need to be present to be linked to land. As I look down on the family walking back to their car, I don't feel part of this world. Too many people, too many damn people everywhere.
Yeah, that's a great, that was a very powerful section for me. How do you feel about that? I mean, you know, I think this book will even encourage people to get out in the wilderness, but you know, the more people go into the wilderness, the less wild it is. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a real problem, but I think the much bigger problem, and Abby, this is one of his pet projects, is overpopulation. And Abby's idea was to close the southern border of America, which I think is a very, very complicated idea. But I think he's right about overpopulation. You know, we're dealing with climate change. And, you know, yes, technology might be able to save us from climate change, but if we have, you know, billions and billions of people on this earth, you know, we might be able to keep it going, but what sort of place is it going to be? Is it going to be, you know, a beautiful, varied, self-willed land, which is what wilderness means? So I think not only do we have to focus on climate change, but we have to focus on overpopulation. We have to, you know, reduce the amount of people on this earth. And this is where Abby got in so much trouble. He advocated for specific ideas. And if I advocated for ideas, I mean, they're dangerous and they're harmful, but we still need to think about how do we begin to change how many people weigh down this earth. And until we do that, we're going to either see wilderness as something not near us because we live in the cities and there is no wilderness near us, or we're going to trample it to death. And it's a sad reality. Sarah and I talk about this a lot. We live about 15 miles north of Montpelier. And how long until it's suburbia? How long until there's houses lining this road, which you drove today? There's no one on that road right now. And it's something I greatly fear. So I want people to engage with the natural world, but I also want us to talk about how do we reduce our weight on this planet, not just individually, but how do we reduce our overall numbers so that we can reach a manageable number so we are part of our environment rather than we are abusing our environment.
Right. We're getting close to the end of our talk here. I had a couple more questions. I don't want to reveal the central mystery that is in your book. It's a delicious one, and I don't want to spoil that for anyone. But I do want to. I wanted to ask you a little bit. There's a great point in the book where you're really doing the map work and the hard work of trying to figure out in this vast area where Edward Abbey's grave might be. Can you talk about how you did that and how a little bit about what that was like?
Yeah. So if you read a variety of things, they'll talk about the Cabeza Prieta National Wildlife Area as being where Abbey may be buried. And it's a pretty small area, merely the size of Rhode Island. So, you know, knowing it may or may not be there is kind of useless. But I remember compiling all my clues in Michigan and having maps out and books out and talking about research. I mean, it was just surrounded by a wall of material. and I figured out where I thought it might be. And I felt really, really confident. And I even called a wildlife biologist and asked him cryptic questions so he wouldn't know what I was doing. And all of his answers lined up. And I felt overly confident in the sense almost that it was preordained that I would find it. And I'm not a person who feels that sort of way. But then once House and I went out into the desert, and I remembered that the desert is three-dimensional, and those mountains on the maps that are flat are actually rising off the earth, then I said, holy moly, this is going to be a little bit more tricky than I expected. And I don't know what area, how many acres our area was. It might have been 5, it might have been 10 that we had narrowed it down to. But once you got out there, it became massive and complex. And I had felt I lost all hope that we'd find it. But again, it's the journey that matters. So even having no hope, I didn't worry. House and I are in the desert. We're exploring. We're adventuring. We're learning. That's plenty.
That's great. I'd like to close. You put a great quote in the book from Ken Kesey kind of about the nature of mystery. And I was wondering if you could finish up just by reading that quote for us.
Of course. And Ken Kesey's book, Sometimes a Great Notion, is one of my favorite novels. One of my favorite authors, Ken Kesey, said in an interview, "The answer is never the answer. What's really interesting is the mystery. If you seek the mystery instead of the answer, you'll always be seeking. I've never seen anybody really find the answer. They think they have, so they stop thinking. But the job is to seek mystery, evoke mystery, plant a garden in which strange plants grow and mysteries bloom. The need for mystery is greater than the need for an answer."
Sean Prentice, thank you so much for being on Write the Book and sharing your book, Finding Abbey, with us. Everyone, you can get this book at your local bookstore. You can order it from University of New Mexico Press. And you can get it from the Evil Empire if you want. But I'm guessing Sean would be happy if you got it locally and did that kind of thing. Is that true?
IndieBound, yep. You can go to IndieBound at any local bookstore.
Oh, IndieBound, great.
We'll get it right to you.
Awesome. But
Gary, thanks so much for having me on. Thanks for letting me be your first guest. It's a real privilege and an honor. Thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
I hope you enjoyed that talk with Sean Prentice. You can learn more about Finding Abbey and Prentice's other work at his website, seanprentice.com. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crow's Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crows Trading Post on Facebook. Sean Prentice offered me two great suggestions for the Write the Book prompts, and I'm going to share them right now. The first is one that Prentice often assigns to his students. Start by finding a piece of writing you love and study it. What is the tone? What is the shape on the page? What is the title? How much dialogue is used? How are characters developed? What is the theme? Once you've studied the piece, then try to emulate it. Write your own piece that mirrors or learns from the piece you love. Allow yourself to follow the original, but to also meander where you need to. That's a great prompt, and here's another one. This one focuses on beginnings and endings. If you have a draft of an essay, story, or poem that you like, but find yourself stuck with the beginning or ending, go ahead and add a second beginning or ending. Just tack it right on. Maybe start or end your piece with an overt idea, or start or end your piece with a scene that moves us to some new place or time. Or start or end your piece with a power metaphoric image. This can be just the kind of writing play you need to get you where you want to go. Thanks so much for listening to Write the Book. If you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know that they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes or at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and the Write the Book radio show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at the website of Write the Book host Shayla Shapiro, and that website is shelaughswithoutus.com. And finally, you can find information about the podcast and about me and my own writing at GaryLeeMiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest, comments about the show, or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. Finally, I'd like to thank Write the Book founder Shayla Shapiro for inviting me to join her as a co-host. It's a tremendous honor, and I'm looking forward to many more great conversations with people from around the literary world. I hope you'll be here to join me. This has been Write the Book. I'm Gary Lee Miller, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont.
It's a hard story with a soft cover. Every heart is double-spaced for a bookmark. There's a bottle so I don't lose my place. Will it get too high or get too low? Stay out of late or just don't go. Say what you want, I'll disagree. I could write a book.
He could write a book
about me. Yeah, I could write a book.
He could write.